You ever been to a sporting event and you're rooting for your team? And look, when we're rooting for our team, no matter what happens, we're going to blame the other team or fate or the weather conditions or whatever else. But have you ever been in one of those experiences where you got the sense that the referee was definitely on the other side? You can't win. You know, I can remember I was a Rockets fan, and the Houston Rockets would play the Utah Jazz every year to have to go to the championship. And there were two straight years, 94 and 95, the non-Jordan years, when the Rockets won the championship. But for every few years before that and after, Karl Malone and John Stockton had these amazing, amazing teams. But it also felt like they had the refs on their side. And Karl Malone would flop, and I hate a flopper. I hate a flopper in soccer. I hate a flopper in basketball. Karl Malone would flop. And every time he flopped, the refs would call a foul. And it was as if you couldn't – it was hard enough to stop Karl Malone because he was so good at what he did on the low post, and he and Stockton with their give and go. But even if – he would put a shot up every time, and if he missed it, he'd flop. And it was as if every time he touched the ball, he was going to score. It was almost impossible to beat him as a result of it. For a long time, we viewed in this country the media as sort of the referee. But that was, you know, liberals and conservatives or Republicans and Democrats. And the media was the one in the middle kind of telling people, hey, here's what's really happening. If you go back to Jefferson and our early founding fathers, you read a lot of references to the fact that free speech and freedom of the press is perhaps more important than any of the election integrity or other constitutional principles that we hold so dear. The freedom of the press was so important that it was built in, it was baked into our Constitution. And somewhere along the way, and it's definitely during my lifetime, and I'm only 51, somewhere along the way that changed, and nobody doubts it. Nevertheless, when it's actually pointed out in full detail, it's even more frightening than you can imagine. There's a new book out called Bad News: How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. It's available now. The author is Batya Unger Sargon. She is deputy opinion editor of Newsweek under our dear friend Josh Hammer, who has really done a wonderful job at Newsweek. I would normally trash Newsweek, but Josh does such a great job. Batya's book is out, Bad News: How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Batya, we all know the media is bad. When you write a book like this, you've got to make us see something far beyond what our gut tells us. Why did you decide to write this?
So thank you so, so much for having me on your show. It's really an honor to be talking to you and to your listeners. So I wrote this book because I couldn't sell the book that I wanted to write, which was called A More Perfect Union. And it was about how Americans are so much less divided than our media and our politicians want us to believe. You know, I had been doing a lot of reporting from the South during the Trump years, and I had been, you know, shocked. This New York City journalist, this lefty, had been shocked by what she found in the South, because I had been led to believe that, you know, it was deeply divided by race and racism, and that people, you know, who were on the other side of the political aisle didn't share any of my values. And when I got down there, what I found was that they shared almost all of my values, and that, you know, all of these battles had been fought and won by the left, and we just weren't talking about it. So things like mass incarceration, where suddenly Republicans are on the forefront of wanting to reevaluate the criminal justice system, police brutality, suddenly you have Republicans calling for police reform, etc. And I had found all of this stuff, and I was so excited about it, Michael, and I wanted to share the gospel of how America was finally living up to its promise and so much more united us than divided us. And I just couldn't sell that book. Nobody wanted to buy it from me. They kept telling me there's no market for this, which is, of course, part of the problem. And finally, an editor sat me down and she said to me, look, you keep telling me that we're so much more united than we are divided. Why do we think we're so divided? You know, why don't you write that book? That's the book that I wrote, Bad News: How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. I wanted to understand why the media was so invested in telling us that we are divided. It's so invested in telling us that every person who voted for President Trump is a racist. Like, why is there such a marketplace for this falsehood? That's what my book is about.
So how do you begin a project like that? You've got 24-hour news cycle. You've got the alphabet soup of ABC, CBS, NBC. Then you've got the cable news channels. Then you've got the magazines that are now mostly online. You have a lot out there. How do you begin to start framing this and wrap your arms around it?
It's such a great question. One of the things that I really wanted to understand was how all of the outlets that you just named, which each one used to have its own flavor, right? Its own point of view, its own audience, but now they're indistinguishable, right? CNN, MSNBC, The New York Times, The Washington Post, they're all going for the same audience and they are all using the same woke language to do that. Why did that happen? Why did these outlets that used to cater to, let's say, 70% of America, why are they now all catering to the 6% who call themselves progressives? Why does that make sense from a business point of view? That's really what I wanted to figure out. And what I found was really surprising, Michael. I found that this is not about race. It's not about politics. It's actually about class. Essentially, over the course of the 20th century, journalism went from a working class trade, a blue collar job. You didn't go to college to become a journalist. You just picked it up by doing it. It was like that for hundreds of years until very recently. Today, it's a very, very elite, highly educated profession. And I believe that as journalists became increasingly highly educated and increasingly educated at elite institutions, the journalism became increasingly addicted to this sort of woke ideology that's really cooked up in universities and has been mainstreamed through the media. So the book starts in the 19th century with the sort of golden age of American journalism, and it was very populist in nature. In fact, Michael, it was a lot like what you do. It was very answerable to the audience. It was all about talking to working class Americans, middle class Americans, where they're at, hearing from them, hearing their stories, giving them a voice, you know, creating a constituency out of them, right? And that's really where I start the book. And I tell the story of how that really got lost in the mainstream media, especially in the liberal mainstream media that today really caters exclusively to affluent, highly educated liberals.
Bhatia Ungar Sargon is our guest. The book is Bad News: How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Let's get to the undermining democracy, because it's one thing if the news media is distasteful. The yellow journalism of William Randolph Hearst and the muckraking and the attempts to garner more listeners when you had the street corner boy that would, you know, extra, read all about it. You know, these horrible things happen. Man has head chopped off. You know, it was a competition in those days, right? And it still is. You're competing for, at that time it was readers and now it's viewers. But let's talk about the long-term consequences. It's one thing if they're putting blood and gore on. It's one thing if they're putting things that isn't real news. But how does this undermine democracy?
So what I argue in the book is that essentially today you have a lot of conservative media catering to conservative elites, you know, to the rich with this kind of trickle down economic point of view that has essentially abandoned the working class. Worse is what you have on the left, which is, you know, the abandonment of the working class, but through this through a woke lens that allows the left to still see itself as being on the side of the little guy when actually it's catering to the top 10% of liberals. And I argue that 90% of Americans, essentially, not only do they not appear in the media, not only are their interests not represented by the media, but that has allowed politicians to ignore them and erase them from the conversation. We no longer have a public sphere. We no longer have a place where the voices of 90% of Americans get heard. And, you know, one of the impacts of that great silencing was the election of Donald Trump. I firmly believe that that was a response to the contempt and the silencing of the working class by the elites. But it is dangerous to democracy, Michael, because this is not a democracy. This is an oligarchy. It's ruled by the elites. That's essentially what we're seeing today. There's a very highly educated liberal elite that believes that it should have, you know, the lion's share, if not the totality of political power. And then you have conservative elites who, you know, and their business interests, which take up a lot of space on the conservative side of things. And, you know, the populist right The socially conservative liberals, these people have no one speaking for them. You know, working class Americans, independent of which side they vote for, tend to have more conservative views. And those views have really been deplatformed and taken out of the conversation. And you have essentially rule by bureaucrat, rule by highly educated elites. And I do think that that is really dangerous, Michael. Like, the point of a democracy is for people to be able to choose, even if they choose the wrong thing. So, for example, you have someone like Anthony Fauci, who really represents this, right? You know, he sees himself as, he said the other day, any criticism of me is criticism of science, because I represent science. He doesn't represent science. He is a person who was appointed to direct public policy, which he has done very poorly, right? But he, as a by politicians on both sides, right? So he, but what he represents to me is that that phenomenon where highly educated elites see the things that are on their political side as objective truths, right? As science, quote unquote, as opposed to they are supposed to be directing what we, the people, want. And you really don't see that anymore. The voice of the people has been taken out of the public conversation in a way that I think is very dangerous.
I saw a post you put up supporting Charles Love, and we spoke to Charles a few weeks back about his book, Race Crazy, BLM 1619, and the progressive racism movement. One of the things this woke media, your book is Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. One of the things I think that the media has done is turn back the tide of 5-6 decades of race relations improvements in this country and set white versus black, and really more sort of left versus right, because the white liberals are on the side of trying to make white people into bad people. But one of the things we've seen as a result of this, I think, is that's where we get Kenosha. That's where we get Waukesha. That's where we get Baltimore and Chicago and Detroit and Atlanta and Houston and New Orleans. And you're seeing a lot of this racial animosity that's spilling over into violence. And I think the media needs to share their fair share of blame, because they choose what to write about and how to write it. And they only seem interested in stoking this narrative.
I could not agree with you more. And speaking of Charles Love, who, you know, one of the people who has had a very, very deep impact on me, I complain about him because he wins all of our arguments when we have debates and when we don't agree. And it's very annoying to lose arguments all the time. But he wrote a piece for us at Newsweek called "Did the Media Bury a Mass Shooting Because the Perpetrator Was Black?" And essentially what happened was, I don't know, I think this was a couple months ago, there was a school shooting. So, you know, as part of my job as opinion editor, I'm like, okay, turning on, you know, all my TVs, right? So I've got Fox on one channel, CNN, MSNBC, and I'm waiting for this school shooting to appear on CNN and MSNBC, right? This is their thing, right? They're going to start calling for gun control, et cetera, et cetera. And only Fox is covering it. And I'm saying that to myself, why is this? Like, why is only Fox covering this mass shooting? I'm waiting and waiting. It's not coming on. And there's like a manhunt on for the perpetrator. There was 3 children shot and 1 teacher. It's like a big story, right? They don't cover it until they catch the guy. And when they caught him, I understood why they hadn't covered this mass shooting. And it was because the perpetrator was black, which meant that in the media's mind, it got filed under crime as opposed to under mass shooting, which meant that they weren't going to cover it, because there's a taboo on covering crime, because it makes white liberals very uncomfortable when people of color commit crimes, because in their mind, in the woke worldview, you know, there's a power binary that gives white people all the power, people of color no power, and then assigns all virtue to the powerless. And I remember sitting there and I was talking to Charles about this. I said, I don't understand. The victims were all black. Like, how could they not be covering this? How could they signal that the lives of these people, they did, actually, thank God, nobody was killed, but that this shooting, the victims of this shooting were literally worth less because they were people of color, and it would embarrass white liberals to talk about it. That's what we're talking about here. The depths of the, and of course, what's even worse is they're not doing this because they're evil. They're doing this because they think this is, you know, how you make the world a better place, right? Like, that's the worst part about it, is that they're all coming at this from this place of, oh, this is the virtuous thing to do.
I no longer believe that, Bhakti. I used to believe that. I used to believe that they were well-intentioned with bad ideas. I now think that this has become the narrative by which they acquire power. Let's say you're Orkin and you're sitting around saying, you know, people are prioritizing buying a new car or a new boat or a new media room instead of having termite or pest control done. Well, we have to make pest control the most important thing in their lives. So you create a cartoon of a termite that's larger than your family storming through your house and wrecking the place, and you scare people into saying, ah, let's call the Orkin man before we buy a new car. And in order to reprioritize, I mean, it's like walking along, you know, Times Square or walking along the Vegas Strip. There are a lot of things catching our attention. So in order to sort of cut through all that, you have to be more salacious. You have to be more controversial. You have to be more adversarial. You have to be conflict. And I think that's what it's about. I think that's also the way the media grabs the attention. And I think that's the way the left grabs the power. Is by pure fear, and you can see that with the vaccine mandates. You can see that with how COVID has been handled. And by the way, you talked about not covering things because of race. I know you've seen it because this is your beat. Look at all the headlines about an SUV crashing in and killing people in Wisconsin. Not the fact that he's a BLM supporter and a Hitler admirer and a black man who was out on bond. You know, this guy's a bad, bad guy. And yet they make it seem that it was some autonomous vehicle that did this. Well, that's because it wasn't consistent with the narrative.
Yeah, there was this great tweet from Nellie Bowles, who's a former New York Times reporter, who's now sort of on the anti-woke beat. And she tweeted something like, I wonder who's radicalizing SUVs. It must be, you know, Joe Rogan or something funny like that, right? Because I think that's exactly the point, is the people writing these headlines are living in fear of, you know, a woke mob on Twitter, of younger people who work at their jobs, right, who have maybe more woke ideas, who went to university more recently, and so their heads are filled with all of this malarkey, right? You know, and so they behave accordingly. You know, it's really an important question, I think, about whether people are motivated by goodwill or not. I, as a former woke, you know, I was until, you know, 2018, I was still pretty woke. So I remember what it feels like to feel not really the fear, but just the this deep and abiding guilt that's been tied to race. And I argue in my book that the reason they've tied the guilt to race is so that we don't have to talk about class, so we don't have to talk about globalization and just the devastating impact it's had on the working class, and to the point where working class Americans are literally committing suicide because they don't see a future for themselves in this country. That's a much harder thing to talk about, because the people who have won out by globalization, the people who have benefited from the economy that is so punishing on the working class, are the white liberals who are journalists, right? The journalist class has become part of the top 10%. It's become increasingly affluent and highly educated. So, you know, I argue, of course, like, yes, there's an intentionality there that sounds like, oh, they're trying to distract. But I do think that it is both things. On the one hand, I totally agree with you that this is a power grab. If you can call your political opponents racist, they do not really deserve any kind of benefit of the doubt, and you can sort of send them to the dustbin, right? So that's, of course, a power grab. But at the same time, when I look at these people, their eyes are burning with fervor, you know, like they really truly believe that there's, you know, a genocide happening against black males. And so it's sort of, it's both, and they reinforce each other, I think.
I fear you're right. The book is Bad News: How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Her name is Batya Ungar Sargon. She is the deputy opinion editor of Newsweek. I highly commend it. The book is out and available now.